Hello, you lovely lot. I wanted to take a moment to share an exciting announcement with you all. I will be doing a live show for Happy Mum, Happy Baby at the Podcast Show in London on the 22nd of May. This will be a live episode of this very podcast featuring me and a very special, soon to be announced, guest. Get ready for a candid conversation, unfiltered truths, laughs, invaluable non-judgmental advice, and lived experiences. Dive into the complexities of parenting while juggling work, relationships, and personal growth. And we'll be talking beyond the baby years. As well as the live episode, the show will also include a Q&A with both me and my guest. Tickets go on sale this Friday the 26th of April at 10 a.m, but anyone who is part of the Happy Mum Happy Baby newsletter will be getting early access to tickets on Wednesday the 24th of April at 10 a.m. To sign up to the newsletter and for more information about the event, please head to happymumhappybaby.com/events. I can't wait to see you there.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
And welcome to a brand new episode of Happy Mum, Happy Baby, the podcast. I am so excited about today's guest. She is a performer, a poet, an author. She has written books like Nobody Told Me, Slug. Her latest offering, Lobster, is out now. She's a daughter of one. No, she's a mother of one daughter. Oh gosh, that's a good start. She has a daughter. Today's guest is Holly McNish. Hello! I am so looking forward to this chat. Like, I know I read Nobody Told Me a long time ago, but I've been listening to it on the audiobook. And like listening to you read your poems and your stories, it's such a different feel as well.
Oh, I'm really glad. It's funny because when they first asked me to do an audiobook, I had only ever heard like not the authors doing it.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, really? Would I do it? And then obviously, if anybody else did, I'd probably be like, oh, that poem, that's not quite how you should.
Yeah, that's not quite the rhythm.
Pause there. Yeah, so it was nice as well because you sort of forget what you've written and then doing the audiobook.
Yeah.
You have to read your whole book again, which I think normally as an author, well, I would never... It's not the book that I want to read, is my own book, you know, So it's funny reliving it and going back. Yeah, it was really nice. I'm really glad. Thanks.
I absolutely love your work because it feels like it really touches you and it makes you realise things you didn't know you needed to hear. You know, whether that's Lobster or Slug or all of them, you know, it does give you a sense of relief in some ways and understanding of the things that we've been told and the things that we've then formed in our brains and in our hearts and kind of going, like, it's that chance to unpick it a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's so nice that you say that because that's exactly how I feel when I'm writing it.
Yeah.
Like all my life, I've just thrown away loads of poems. I moved house after like 8 years and I've just, to be honest, I got worried because somebody was talking about like poetry archives in museums and stuff. And I got worried that if I died, I'd have all this stuff left that either my daughter would need to read through all these terrible poems or somebody might be like, oh, she might want to publish them. And I definitely don't. So
Holly McNish's worst poems.
Got rid of loads of them. But reading through them, they were all from like teenage years and stuff. And it's always been like that. Like I feel such a relief writing them down or trying to figure stuff out by writing a poem about it, which is sort of the two reasons why I've always written.
Yeah.
It's so much to play with language and stuff, although it is a little bit more now. But yeah, so it's really nice when people say that, I guess the effect of reading it is quite similar on them to the effect that it is to me writing it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Is it then weird though going on tour, because you're obviously on tour now, is it weird then going on tour and almost reliving or talking about things that have happened that have inspired different pieces and maybe feeling differently about those things now?
Yeah, it's a it to be honest, it's weird at first, but then I think I sort of get used to it because I normally have only about 2 or 3 months in the year that I'm not touring, just because everything's around being a mum.
Yeah.
So I don't do these sort of, you know, 4 week intense tours. I just do kind of 2 gigs a week the whole time. So you sort of get used to it. But yeah, it is a bit odd. I guess if I felt really weird reading a certain bit, I probably just wouldn't read
That's
it.
That's true.
Like I really am not I'm not a kind of, I don't know, performer or reader or whatever who wants to push myself to, you know, uncomfortable limits in
any way.
You
don't need to.
I don't need to. I used to do stuff off by heart and that used to make me sick before gigs. I was like, I can just read it from this book. What are you doing to yourself? Like I'm not so bothered about that. And I guess if something makes me feel really strange, then I probably wouldn't publish it. I'd write it down, but then I'd, you know, bin it like I have.
Really? Have you just binned loads of, like, do you just constantly get it down and if it sticks, it sticks, and if not, it was just nice to get it out?
Yeah, I feel like that. It's nice to get it out. And some of them I save, but I guess I went through and thought, would I want anyone else to read this? Because it is like a diary.
Yeah.
And I guess I've published loads of them, so I've got all these memories. So it's sort of the case. I remember my mum said to me when I was younger, like, don't write anything down that you wouldn't want anyone to read, when I started the diary, which is quite funny because it's sort of my whole career. But
there's also something about poems, I think, and your work. I remember also reading... when I had my now 5-year-old, I read This Is Gonna Hurt, that by Adam Kay, during the night feeds. It's something about having those nuggets that you can take as individual pieces during a feed or when you're up with an unsettled baby. Like, there's something really lovely about that.
So I think that's, again, the same. Like, I wrote, well, nobody told me, it was purely a diary.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's about 3 little sections that I added sort of in hindsight because there were a few gaps. When I say a few sections, I mean like literally like 4 pages or something that weren't just specific diaries. And I wrote it in little bits because I haven't had, you know, this idea of going away for 3 weeks to concentrate on a book. Like, I had my daughter, you know, I was pregnant at 26. Like, I've never had that sort of writing retreat experience. So I guess maybe the reason I write in these little chunks, and there's a little essay and then there's a poem and then all this stuff, is because I've had these little...
Like snatched times.
Moments.
Yeah.
Which, and that's why, it's why I love writing poetry, I think, because there's so... You know, they say that the people in the jobs where they're happiest is when you sort of finish something. Like, I've heard that gardeners and hairdressers, that seems to be one of the kind of happiest professions, because you get to see the results of a lot of what you're doing.
Mm.
And I feel like that with poetry, rather than spending sort of 3 years on a novel, which I think must be really difficult. I just love the fact that there's so many of these, like, we finish products while I'm writing.
Yeah.
It's really nice. And then I just have to work out which ones to put in or cut out or burn, you know.
No one can ever know this even existed.
No one's ever going to read this teenage poem that I wrote. Never.
I think you get that when you read your work, that it's a reflective of those moments. And I also feel like it feels like an offload and an insight that you just wouldn't get if it was written in any other moment. Do you know what I mean? That's what always blows my mind.
Yeah.
Like, reflection or kind of being able to look at something 10 years from when it actually happened is very different to writing in the moment when something's just occurred.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's why I find it so funny with Nobody Told Me, because that, I mean, all of my poems are written like in the moment, but I guess with that one, because it was like in the thick of like pregnancy and early motherhood, which is, you know, the least time I've ever had ever by myself to do anything. Like, there's loads of poems there that when I read those ones, I've got this real urge to edit them. Like, I really like poems that like look good on a page and the certain stanzas, and I read them back now and I'm like, oh, that should have been like 4 lines break, 4 lines break. But instead it's just this long text. But I wrote it at 3 in the morning.
Yeah, and motherhood is messy. Totally.
And it was really weird trying to work with an editor who's brilliant. It's Wim Rhiannon. to think, okay, I don't want to not edit anything because I obviously want to learn and I want it to be a book that's good to read.
Yeah.
But I don't really want to edit the poems because that poem is written like that.
Yeah.
Because that's what I had at that time to give. So I feel like editing them, I don't feel like that with all poetry, but I feel like that with this book, that it would have been a little bit of a
take away
lie
the essence
if it was too tidied up.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
so having been listening to it recently, my sister-in-law, Carrie, has just given birth and I've never had more of an urge to send a book to someone.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah. I just think
if you do, I hope she enjoys it.
Thank you very much. I'll let you know. I've got no doubt. Absolutely no doubt. Holly, what was your childhood like? Because I've got to say, I absolutely adore your interaction and respect and love for your elders and your family and how it feels like everyone's voice is such a massive part of your life.
Yeah, that's a big question.
I mean, childhood, just go straight to childhood.
Probably things I wouldn't share, but mainly it was lovely. It was lovely. It was really nice. It was, I have written loads about it in the book. So I was brought up just outside Reading in a little village and went to the local schools. But my family, my mum and dad are both from Glasgow, or like just on the edge of like the east side of Glasgow. And all the rest of my family are from around that area.
Yeah.
So I sort of spent my childhood mainly in England at my home, but also going between Scotland, kind of wishing I was Scottish a little bit. Like there's quite a lot of that in Lobster that I was slightly worried about my family reading.
But do you ever think, what would have happened if they'd have stayed in Scotland? Like, all the influences that you would have had, but like, obviously, you would have had a Scottish accent. Like, your life would be totally different. It's like that sliding doors thing of who would Holly McNish be if you'd have grown up somewhere else? Who would any
of
us be?
Yeah. Just don't know, but I think I would have preferred my accent.
Have you never tried to learn it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In my head, I've got quite a strong Glaswegian accent, more like my sort of dad's side of the family. My mum's side, a lot of them are from like Stirling and Dunblane and places like that. But so sometimes when I'm writing poems, and this sounds really weird, but especially if I'm in Scotland at the time and I'm writing the poems in my head, they've quite often got a Scottish accent. And weirdly, sometimes I even have to change a rhyme because it doesn't rhyme when I read it out loud. So when I edit poems, I always read them out loud and sort of walk around the room reading it over and over again. And because I cut it like that, and I bore myself sometimes with the longer ones, and I think definitely I need to cut and cut and cut a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's certain rhythms and rhymes that don't work because in my head I wrote it
being Scottish.
I don't have. And certain words.
I love that, just a realisation as you're reading it out loud. Oh yeah, I don't have a Scottish accent. No. I'm Scottish but without the accent. Did you have a creative childhood?
Yeah, I think so. Sometimes I feel like I'd be insulting my family when I answer questions like this.
Right.
Because I did, but not in a way like we didn't sit around and read poems to each other or anything.
See, I think sometimes for like our generation, a creative childhood is being allowed to just have that freedom to just go off. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
sometimes it's that, isn't it?
Yeah, it was more one of the ones. Like, I spent a lot of time like throwing a ball to myself against the house.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like lots of things that sometimes when we talk about kids nowadays being on their phones and computers all the time, like I was also that.
Right.
I just didn't have a phone. I had like a Game Boy. And I mean, I played Lemons for hours with my mates and I watched so much TV. So everything, I feel like everything that a lot of people worry about with their kids, I know it's different because there's, you know, internet and stuff now, but I spent a lot of time watching telly.
Yeah.
At home. Like we watched, like we my mum's in the other room and I feel like she might be listening, but we ate dinner watching telly. Like we didn't sit around a table really and talk. But they were great programmes, like all the comedies and stuff I love. And me and my daughter, like my kid watches loads of telly, and then I hear people like, oh no, it's so bad for you. And I was thinking, well, I don't think it was that bad for me. Like loads of what I learned, I think I learned from like Fresh Prince of Bel-Air,
yeah,
Blossom,
uh-huh,
whatever, all the 6 o'clock comedies and stuff. I love them. I used to watch hours of MTV when I got older, MTV music videos, which I loved, and God knows what I was learning from them.
Yeah.
So I wasn't, I loved reading when I was about, up to about 12.
Right.
And I read loads of Roald Dahl books, but I think it kind of dropped off once I started studying a lot at school because I just didn't want to, I didn't want to pick up books. Like, I did really well in school, but I wasn't sitting in books all evening at home. I was watching telly.
That's so true. I've never really thought about that. But we used to have a TV in our dining room. So we used to watch Eggheads and then The Simpsons. You know, that was our meal. And we would talk, but we had the TV there. And then after that, we'd go into the living room and we'd watch Emmerdale, Coronation Street, EastEnders, Brookside, you know. And if I had a lamp on because I was reading, they'd tell me to turn it off.
You know. And Christmas Day, we sat around a table, but there was still Blind Date was still on.
Yeah.
Still running, just catch the end of it and stuff. Yeah. So I did have a creative one, but not the sort of your kids in five art classes sort of creative one, which is also, I'm sure, great. But, you know, like my daughter's given up pretty much every club that she started now. And where I live, like loads of people every single night, their kids do something different. And sometimes I remember somebody saying, oh, are you free after school to meet up? And then I was like, yeah. Like if I'm at home and I'm not on tour a couple of days a week when my daughter's at her dad's, we're not together, but we live really close to each other. So 2 days a week, she's at her dad's in the week. And those are the days that I normally do my gigs. So I was like, yeah, well, if when I'm here, we're here. And then she was like, oh, actually, we're not free any day after school because there's a like club every day. And I think it's quite normal. And I had the guilt for like a couple of years. I was like, oh, my kids like stop reading so much at home. And she's like, just doesn't want to do the clubs anymore. But she's fine. Like, she's pretty much doing what I did, wanting to see mates, playing computer games, reading occasionally. But when I look at textbooks from school, I'm like, oh yeah, you do actually sit and read and write all day at school. I don't know. I know it's brilliant.
It's hard to find the love of it.
There's so much worry in a parent.
Looking ahead to your future when you were younger, in your teens, early 20s, did you picture yourself with a family? Did you and Dee ever talk about having a family?
Not really, no. No, I didn't really. There are a lot of other things that I definitely thought I wanted to do. I definitely thought I wanted to like move to France because I was quite obsessed with learning languages. But I didn't. But I do remember when I got to about 24, I remember thinking, okay, if I did happen to get pregnant now, I'd probably keep it. I remember thinking that, like, it wouldn't, if I got pregnant now, it would be okay.
Yeah.
I remember having that feeling. And I remember saying that to friends and then being like, what? So it must have been in my head a little bit.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's such a weird thing, isn't it, when you get pregnant? Because I remember so many people asking if it was planned because I had just finished uni, really. I'd just finished doing a master's part-time, so it took, you know, 2.5 years rather than one and a bit. And people asking was it planned, and I was like, what do you want me to say? Like, I obviously know how babies are made. Do you want me to like describe like the fact it was unprotected or a condom breaking or whatever? Like, what are you gonna, which isn't, I, you know. And but yeah, and I remember saying it was unplanned, and somebody said, oh, a mistake. And I was like, no. It was intentionally meant to be a negative thing that they said to me. People are really, really rude sometimes. Like, they're really intrusive and annoying, I think, in terms of parenting and motherhood in general. I think at that age, I started thinking that would be okay. Or maybe a friend said, oh, what would you do if you got pregnant? And I was a bit blasé about, like, might be okay.
Yeah.
And then they're like, what? That sort of thing.
Can you remember finding out you were pregnant?
Yeah. And it was on the way It's weird when I say stuff that I've written about, because sometimes I feel like I'm making it up. Like I'm just telling someone a story that I've read, but it really is true.
And also because you'd have thought about how you worded it when you wrote it down. And so yeah. kind of to say something that's not that thought through, totally. You know. Yeah.
Yeah. Or if I do say exactly the same, it's like, oh, that's just a line. She's read that.
Say it to me in poetry form. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. It was the first time I performed at Glastonbury. I got asked to read poetry at Glastonbury and I did the pregnancy test. I think I'd done another one first, but I didn't put that in the book. Like there's certain things that I leave out that are really private that I've sort of cut out of my diaries, like my kids' favourite, you know, songs and stuff like that. To me, that's private, much more private than talking about my feelings about sex or anything. But yeah, it was at King's Cross toilets that I found out I was pregnant. But I knew.
Yeah.
I think. And my mum is a nurse and she'd said to me quite a few times, "Are you sure you're not pregnant, are you?" Because my boobs had got big and they're really small. So I guess she could see. And then I had quite bad. I'm not calling it morning sickness because it's not in the morning. So I had quite bad pregnancy sickness from quite early on.
Right.
So I had like these sort of bigger boobs and I was like, "Oh, Mum, I'm just going to go to the toilet. I feel a bit sick." And she was like, "Sure, you're not pregnant?" But no. So I guess she sort of told me.
Yeah.
But it's such a strange feeling looking back, because I guess I know a lot of people try for years and it can be so traumatic, and then other people try and it's all the sort of, well, it used to be the sort of advert you'd see, and yeah, it's positive, like that sort of thing. But it was, because I was happy about it, but it wasn't like a planned thing that I'd been trying for a kid. But it was still quite a weirdly magical, like a sort of magical moment.
I mean, it's a very surreal thing when that line or that, you know, the word pregnant comes up on one of those sticks.
So weird. So that's why the COVID tests are so weird, aren't they? Like anyone that's ever done a pregnancy test, like, guys, could you have designed this differently? Because this is bringing back a lot of memories every time I do one of these tests.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I remember I was, at Glastonbury Festival, basically in a tent on my own just for the weekend, just thinking, I can't believe I'm pregnant. And I didn't tell anyone apart from this one guy, really nice guy, whose stage name is Dreadlock Alien. Real name's Richard, I'm pretty sure. But he was really nice and let me like sleep in his van because my tent started leaking. Oh. I remember on like the first night. But it was really nice being there, weirdly, just seeing all these sort of kids wandering around and people having quite a lot of fun with
celebrating
kids.
Life.
Yeah, it was really nice. It was so nice to have a, I know lots of people obviously do it with their partners, but I wanted to say face-to-face to her dad, so I wasn't interested in, like, calling him. But I think I wanted to do it on my own.
Really?
Like, I wanted to have a bit of time on my own because it's massive. It's, like, it's such a massive deal for both people, but it's a bigger deal for mums. It's, like, your body and you're sort of thinking about that. Yeah. Is actually happening inside you and stuff. But I'm quite glad that I sort of had just a few days to think about everything. And yeah, sometimes there's so much stuff about motherhood and so much pressure. It's quite nice to just have this sort of...
It can almost feel like you're meant to feel certain things at certain moments. So when they don't happen in that way, you're like, that's weird.
Totally.
Something's wrong already. You know,
yeah, and it takes away from your experience. I'd love to go back again and just cut out all the voices telling me what sort of fucking dresses I should be wearing as a pregnant woman. Like, down to everything. You're sort of told what to think, what to wear, well, obviously what to eat and all the kind of health stuff. But yeah, it's nice looking back, I think. I didn't love being pregnant, but I think a lot of that was to do with other people.
Yeah.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Did it take you a while to get your head around the fact that you were pregnant? So obviously that's such a massive, it's such a massive life shift. And it does, you know, I think probably being at Glastonbury and seeing those families there and kind of going, yeah, and life continues. It's not a full stop, you know.
Exactly. And people that go to Glastonbury with their kids are people that are comfortable with parenting. So I think mainly comfortable, I think. I think I saw like a really good... It was a really good place to be because, yeah, if you, I mean, I ended up taking my daughter when she was, I realised now she was 3 months old, actually, when I went. I was saying, oh, yeah, because we took her when she was about a year. And I was like, oh, no, she would have been 3 months. So there's got to be some sort of comfort if you are going to take your kid to a festival like that. So I guess I saw a lot of people that were quite kind of chilled.
Yeah.
Parents, which was, yeah, that was. It was very helpful. But it's so quick, isn't it? And I guess because I thought that I would probably have, like, maybe I'd have one kid, or I hadn't really thought about it so much.
Yeah.
One kid or none, or I wasn't really sure. But I think having one kid, it's quite weird, kind of knowing, like, I didn't want another child, but knowing that everything you then experience, you probably won't experience that again.
Yeah.
So with pregnancy, I think that's why I'm a bit more annoyed about the negativity or the pressure to be ecstatically happy all the time, because I feel like it robbed me a bit of this like unbelievably amazing thing that was going on in the body. And it's only afterwards when I wrote Nobody Told Me and other poems about being pregnant, and I started to get invited to like midwifery conferences.
Right.
And watching people doing talks about the like body changes when there's a, you know, when you're pregnant, and with breastfeeding, I think that was a massive one with me, because I did breastfeed and I didn't really have many physical issues. Like I found it impossible to pump milk for some reason, but I didn't really persevere that much. I was like, this is taking too long. I could have just fed her.
Yeah.
I had a bit of that attitude, but I remember seeing like a diagram of like the internal workings of the body, like the sort of shifting and changing and all this. I was like, oh my God, that's incredible. Like, what is going on? And like learning things to do with your body and feeding and after birth. And all I'd seen was the sort of get back into shape after birth bollocks. Well, not bollocks. Like if you, you know, want to, you know, get your muscles built up or what, but the bollocks of like really this the idea that jump back on the treadmill, yeah, like annoying. And that's all. And there was no, I felt like there was no like amazement about it all.
Mm.
Like,
look at what your body's doing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Like, and it's terrifying. I think that as well, like Lobster, the new book's got a section about newborn, but looking back. And I've been researching like nightmares that other people had, because I had loads of nightmares when I was pregnant. Thought I was the only one, as you so often do, think you're the only one with a lot of things, and all the like, some hilarious nightmares people had that their baby was born and it was like a mini Mick Hucknall, that singer, every time.
Well, I wrote Dream a Little Dream, so it was a fiction book. I think it was my third novel, but that was inspired by my pregnancy dreams, because weird shit would happen. Weird. Oh, I birthed a cat.
Yeah, mine was a goat. Always a goat. Yeah.
How was your labour?
It was... according to the medical sheets, it was normal and uncomplicated.
Right.
And that's what the tick box said.
And in
so
your
everything
experience?
Went well. So nothing to complain about here. I had one stitch.
Right.
Breastfeeding was fine straight after. But I everything went well, but I hope it's as close to death as I'll ever come before I die. I really thought I was going to die. Like when I was told to keep pushing and pushing, and then it was like, oh, you know, not getting anywhere, put into a water bath.
Yeah.
And then sat on one of those sort of looked like a toilet seat sort of thing. And then, no, keep pushing, keep pushing. And I remember thinking my face is going to explode if I push anymore. Mm. Like my lungs are going to explode. I thought I'm going to kill myself by pushing. And then like my water bag didn't break. Right. So I had, I was told while in labour that was very lucky that seamen used to buy water bags that hadn't broken because it was meant to like stop the ships from sinking or something. But it was like mid labour. I was told how lucky it was. But I don't think I've ever described this before, not in any books or anything, but I had like my baby's head like, you know, sort of ready to come out, but a bit of the water bag had come out. So I had this like, it was like a water balloon like hanging out of my vagina. And then they said, oh no, it's not going to happen in the maternity ward. So then they put me in a wheelchair, took me down to the main general hospital ward. And what I remember then is the maternity ward was so nice and it was so like dimly lit and calm. But obviously they thought, you know, we need to get this baby out. Put me in the lift. And when the lift doors opened, I was in like a busy hospital ward with no pants on, just in this wheelchair. And I don't remember if anyone covered me up, but I feel like I was so exposed. Like just people there, you're not used to people seeing you naked.
Well, and that's such a vulnerable time.
Yeah, especially with half a water bag hanging out. And I just remember thinking, this is like the most humiliating thing, just being sort of pushed. But obviously very good that they did. But in the end, actually, the doctor went to get, what do you call it? Not pliers. That is not the name.
Forceps.
Those forceps. And then I pushed and she came out. And I remember they had coming out and then somebody saying to somebody, tell her to push because this is going to feel like there's fire. Something like that to do with the shoulders now coming. And I heard it and it was like the worst thing I could have heard. And that was the doctor that said that. Whereas I guess maybe the midwife's
would have worded
were a
it
bit
differently.
Calmer with me.
Yeah.
And brilliant, really. But yeah, so it was I found it really hard, but I was told really good, like really good, really lucky, you know, one stitch, nothing. So I do feel really lucky. But I didn't have any, I had like a paracetamol and that was it. And then when I asked for, what was it, gas and air?
Yeah.
They said it was too, like I was too far dilated or whatever it is. To do it. So, but I didn't have a big plan. I was like, I don't know. I was 26 and I was sort of, I didn't have like a birthing plan and stuff that I definitely wanted. I knew I wanted to try to breastfeed out of like lots of reasons, but also out of economic reasons. Just thinking, I don't want to pay for this. I don't want to pay for something and I don't want to have to heat up bottles and carry stuff with me.
Yeah.
So I feel with that, I feel really, really lucky.
So you were feeding and that all went really well. You're like your feeding journey with her.
Yeah, it was totally fine. I guess that's also what I find a bit, that idea of people sort of taking away experiences is that it physically, it was totally fine. Like, don't get me wrong, a couple of times, like that sort of cramping feeling you can feel when it's like down. Contracting your womb back, which also that is amazing. Like, and it's not amazing saying if you can't feed or you don't want to like breastfeed that will be, you know, worse. But these sort of mechanisms of the body, I wish I'd have learned more about that when I was pregnant, because I think there would be a bit more of a fascination with my body, not just this kind of disgust for it in a way. And it really makes me sad that I was in anyway disgusted my own body.
And the amount of time that we've wasted having those thoughts about our bodies.
Oh, yeah. And not obviously that's for everyone, not just people that have like given birth.
No.
But yeah, amazing. But physically it was totally fine. And it was psychologically that it was hard.
Mm.
And I think that pisses me off a lot now. all the sort of weird things that people say about feeding, like breastfeeding. It's like, yeah, well, it's fine, but just do it discreetly. Like, that makes me want to punch people in the face. I'm really amazed that I haven't got violent with people. And I'm not a violent person.
But the thing that you do is you put it into poetry, and that's the most amazing thing.
So yeah, because I'm not strong enough.
Was it embarrassed?
To punch.
Was that the was the time not strong enough to punch? the poem that's all about breastfeeding, essentially tits on billboards and stuff. Does that called embarrassed?
Yeah, it's called embarrassed, and I literally wrote that while sitting on a public toilet. And I wrote it on my phone, which you're not meant to have a phone near a baby's head, which I didn't know at the time. And I'm very sorry with that. But I wrote it on in a public toilet in Cambridge because one person had made a comment. It wasn't like loads of people made comments about me feeding. But I think that is how vulnerable a lot of new parents are, is that it does not take a lot to make you feel utterly embarrassed or ashamed, or like you're interrupting public space. I think we're pretty crap in the UK with, you know, all the play parks, for example. They're like outside of the town centres. Like all the spaces that I was used to as somebody without a kid were now like not available when you had a baby. Whereas like I've done gigs in Spain recently, and loads of the squares are built around a big plaza with a park, restaurants, cafes, and you see all these new parents sitting, having a glass of wine or a beer or a pizza or whatever, and there's a play park, and then their teenage kids are sort of scooting about, and it's pedestrianised. Like, just that. I used to work in an urban planning charity for like 7 years, and it's amazing how this sort of thing makes a difference. And I remember thinking, as soon as I had my kid, it's like, oh, I'm not welcome in any of the places that I go as an actual adult person. And now if I want to do anything, I either go to like a Rhyme Time library group, which, don't get me wrong, are incredible, but I don't want to listen to nursery rhymes for my free time.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel like there was anything where it's like acknowledged that there was a parent there.
Yeah.
It was just acknowledged that there was babies and toddlers, apart from sort of toddler groups, which were a real lifeline, but like play parks, just that they were all out on the edge of everything going on. And there was nowhere that they had places that you could get some food or drink.
Yeah.
They're just like, oh, you've got a baby now. Piss off.
Which I always feel like it feels very different to being pregnant. I can remember people opening doors for me, people being really, really nice. As soon as the baby arrived, different vibes.
Yeah, different vibes. And actually, the only places that do it, annoyingly, are places like McDonald's, where you go and there's a play area in the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas so many other countries, they just have squares of restaurants with just a little bit. It doesn't. Also, it's not a lot that it takes, is it? Like one cafe I used to go to all the time because they had one cardboard box with 10 kids' books in it. And that was like amazing because you felt like you were welcome.
Yeah.
I think it's that idea. And all those feelings that I had, now I've started going abroad more to do gigs. It's like, oh, it's not because I did something wrong by having a kid. It's because it's just even down to the design of a city, or like in Finland, I went on a train and accidentally booked the family carriage on a train in Finland and went into this room and just burst into tears because I had to take my kid on the train all the time for gigs and to visit family in Scotland. So many times sat on the floor, so many times had to wake her up, which again, I can't imagine what it's like to have two kids.
Yeah.
Had people making comments like, oh God, I wouldn't take a kid on rush hour. It's like, well, I haven't chosen to do that, but I have to get to work.
Yeah.
I have to. And I walked into this carriage, and it was half of it was seats and the other half was a little library space with a sort of gate so the babies could crawl around, and a slide on a train, and it was no extra cost, it was just normal on the long haul trains. And I was like, oh, all of the train journeys that I ever did with my kid added to the feeling that I was a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And actually that wasn't because I was a pain in the ass, it's because you had nowhere for me to put my pushchair. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
You had nowhere for me to sit beside a sleeping baby.
Yeah.
That was it. That was all it was, because you want to fill every section of this thing with a seat so you can make
As much money as possible.
Money.
Yeah.
That was it. That was it. And loads, you know, loads of stuff like that. Yeah, it'd be so nice to just create a place with all these different things from different countries.
Yeah. Obviously, your daughter is now 14.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So you've gone through loads of different stages. How is it sort of reflecting back? And in some ways, do you find looking back at the newborn, I sometimes find myself looking back going, gosh, why did I find that so hard? Because now I've got a child who has an opinion and has a voice and has, you know, the capacity to go, no.
Yeah. I don't know. I always say I have only got one child.
Yeah.
Which I do think makes a difference. And also, I guess it's, I've just been living with her for 9, 10 years.
Yeah.
And co-parenting, which means that for all that time, I've had 2 days definitely every week where I don't have my kid with me.
Yeah.
Which is a very different setup. And there are things about it that are really great. So when I talk to a lot of my friends who have more than one kid, or I guess they're in relationships where they really are doing like everything with their kids and they haven't even had a night away, I can't really fathom it.
Yeah.
So it's very different, I think, the experience, but still, I think looking back, but just having a niece who I don't see as much as I'd like we don't live really, really close to each other. But even going around today, just the intensity of not being able to take your eyes off a child, it's so tiring. And it's unreal that, and also not really being able to do anything kind of adult for your brain and just repeating games over and over again whilst you can't do anything else.
Yeah.
And if you do, if you dare to put your kid in a pushchair and, you know, send some emails, then you'll get scowls from people being like, mother on her phone, what bitch. So I don't miss it at all. There's so much about it that I don't miss. And I do miss just the amazing things about every different stage of having a kid. I really miss it.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things I feel like most, and I have written a poem about it. There's a poem in Lobster called, thing is, I'm still really fucking great at being a horse. And it's true. I had to be a horse for like 3 years after every gig, which no one, you know, obviously knew, but I took my kid to loads of gigs with me and had to. And it was so, like when she was little, it's like I put the curtains of, when I was like on the microphone at the stage, I'd have them bring the curtains really close to me so she could sit right next to me behind the curtains.
How is it having a teenage daughter?
It's lovely and terrifying, I'd say. I think that sums it up. It's terrifying. And I guess it depends on what your daughter's like.
But do you also feel like, so a lot of what you do, I would say for me, is cutting through the crap, you know, and you're kind of like, if every young woman read your work, they would ease themselves off of years and years of therapy, essentially, right? If you are the mother of that child, you carry this wisdom, I'm going to call it wisdom, but how much does she absorb that? Or are you still like, oh, shush, mum?
Yeah, of course. I mean, she's not read, I've told her not to read any of course, my books and she doesn't, you know, it's not like she's like, oh, mum, I'd love to read your poems. I'd find it a bit weird if she was like that, really. Yeah. Like at every gig, people say, do you like your mum's poems? And they've been saying it since she was like 3. It's like, no. Like, stop asking her. Of course she doesn't. No one likes their mum's poems. She's, I've told her that, but there's other books that I sort of want her to read or just poets that I like it if I'm doing a gig and they're doing it.
Yeah.
And I think, all right, I've said to her sometimes, like, I know she watches movies when I'm doing the gig, so she doesn't like hear my stuff.
Yeah.
I guess I just did that since she was little because it's not suitable for kids. But I like it when there's other people that I know, and then she gets to listen to that.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it's one thing. I'd love it if I could give her the sort of messages, but it's different coming from
your mum.
And also, it's, yeah, it's talking about sex is fine or masturbation or whatever, but you don't want to hear your own mum talking about it too much. I don't think, or maybe it doesn't matter. But, yeah, so, no, she's definitely not like, tell me, mum.
You're not the oracle for her.
Your wise words for me. She's more like, uh-huh. And then, I think, like, every kid, really.
Yeah. Holly, I know you've written so much about motherhood, but if you could write a letter about motherhood, one letter, who would it be to and what would you say?
It would be to the people in charge of city design and town design. And I would say, here are some examples from Barcelona and Finland and Japan. Please, could you mimic these the next time you design any new town centres? That's what I would say. Or I'd send a letter to myself or any new parent or mum saying, like, you've done nothing wrong. Like, you're not, you know, if you don't feel welcome, that's not because you've done something wrong. It's just because we're a load of dicks. But I think just the idea that you haven't done anything wrong by having a baby, no matter what situation you are in, mm-hmm. you have not done something wrong. So don't let people or the design of a shop or, you know, someone's look or whatever it is, or the design of a play park being at the end of a field down the back, down the corridor. Don't let that make you feel like you've done something wrong.
Yeah. And finally, I would love you to complete three sentences. First one, being a mum means.
I wrote these down.
Oh.
Because I didn't want to just be like, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So being a mum means I have half the time to write down poems about things that I want to write about 10 times more than I ever have.
Oh, I love that. Since having a child,
since having a child, I have way more knowledge and skills about certain things than I ever dreamed I would have.
Like being a horse.
Like being a horse. But I could use that in different ways, okay?
For children on trains, which you are fine to talk to.
Imagine that. By the way, if you do want to be a horse, they'd be like, get this woman off the train.
And finally, I'm happy when...
Oh, I didn't know this was the third one. I'm happy when, I'm eating with my child or friends.
I love
people
this.
That I love. Yeah.
I love this very, very much.
That was a very last minute thought.
Eating. So every word was... And I'm going to add it.
I think I'm quite happy most of the time. That's the thing. And I think it's annoyed quite a few people. But I feel like my mum teaches me to feel quite grateful. I don't really have that much to feel ungrateful for.
Also, so I think that a large part, you have this creative outlet where you can just, you know, get it out, whatever you're feeling, it is out of you. It's down on the page. Yeah. You're no longer carrying it around.
Totally. Yeah, and sharing it with people, I think, has made me feel like most of the things, if you ever feel so bad about something or you're going through something or you feel whatever it is, about anything really, but I guess specifically parenting, like, please don't feel like you're the only one feeling it, because you're definitely not.
Yeah.
I think that's what I found out most through, not through writing, but through sharing poems, like embarrassed. I really thought I was the only one going into toilets to breastfeed because I didn't talk about it, and that has been the most shared.
Were you surprised by that?
Yeah, like, I didn't include it in the first book. When someone asked me if I'd published a book, I didn't include it in the book. And there's other books about other poems about motherhood, because I just thought it's quite a long poem and I didn't think it would be very like relatable. So when I am picking poems, I write loads and then I think, well, what do I want to share, or what would be nice to share or helpful to share? And I just thought, well, that's just me sort of complaining because I went into the toilet. So after that got shared loads, it made me realise I don't really have a clue what other people are going through. Yeah. So now I just share everything. Either like on Instagram and then or in books. But yeah, I just think there was another one called Period Diarrhea, which my mum isn't, you know, particularly a lover of that poem. But
it's a thing that it's only when people talk about it, you're like, oh, we all have it.
Didn't know it was. Genuinely didn't know it was. Shared it and people were like, yeah. And then I had like nurses writing back, oh, yeah, that's because the body does this and it doesn't know what it, you know, to expel and stuff. And I was like, mum, look, it's not just our family. So, yeah, now everything can be shared unless it's going to, you know, insult someone or whatever. And that stuff I write down and then burn.
You've just got a big burning pile.
Just a big burning pile, yeah.
Holly, thank you so, so much. Like I said, I absolutely love your work and everything that you put out there. Honestly, it's just such a freeing thing to read what you put down. And I absolutely adore it. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. And thank you for what you do as well. It's just gorgeous. And it's really, really a thrill and honour to be on here today.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Holly.